Welcome to Art for All, the Sketchbook School podcast. I'm your host, Danny Gregory. Each week I bring you stories, ideas, interviews, and inspiration to keep you company while you work on your own creative project, whether you're drawing your dog or welding a monumental sculpture, designing an office tower, screen printing a t-shirt, or making a really good grilled cheese. I hope this episode inspires you to do your best work. That's our mission at Sketchbook School, to help encourage art for all, including you, of course. A couple of quick reminders. We are about to embark on a very exciting new course called Watercolor Rules and How to Break Them. And time is running out to sign up because we start on Monday, September 17th. So get over to sketchbook.school and check it out. And if you're listening to this episode at some point after September 17th, you can still join the course because it'll also be available on demand. But I promise, no matter your experience level with watercolor or when you take it, you are going to love this course. Love it. I do. I also want to let you know something else you should actually get right on, which is that we are soon going to raise the price of a ticket to SketchCon, our first ever drawing and painting convention in Pasadena, November 2nd through 4th. And the faster you sign up, the less it's going to cost you if you want to, you know, save more money for buying art supplies. To find out more about this amazing event, visit sketchcon.com. That's con with a K. And you'll see all the incredible events and speakers and sponsors and sketch crawls and social events and fun that we have lined up for you. It's going to be amazing. Okay, on to this week's episode. As soon as we first came up with the idea of SketchCon, I knew who I absolutely had to have as a speaker, Austin Kleon. Austin is one of my favorite writers and thinkers about the creative process. He's a poet, a collage artist, a blogger, an author, a diarist, and as he says, a writer who draws. Austin is the author of several New York Times bestsellers on the creative process. Steal Like an Artist. Maybe you've heard of that one. 10 Things That Nobody Told You About Being Creative. A beautiful square little yellow book. No, it's not yellow, actually. It's black. A black book. Show Your Work is the one that's yellow. Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered. Now, if you don't know these books, treat yourself to a copy of both of them. They are smart and funny and ingenious, and you will come back to them time and again. I reread them both every year. I have them on my Kindle. Whenever I have a spare moment and I'm looking for a kick in the butt, I open one of Austin's books, and they're always full of new and refreshing ideas to get me going. So Austin and I have had a number of deep and sort of far-ranging conversations over the years, and I wanted to make sure that I could get him to come to Pasadena to share his insights with our community and you. Even though he's finishing up a brand new book, it's called Keep Going, A Guide to Staying Creative in Chaotic Times, he agreed that, nonetheless, he would make time for us, and he will be there on Saturday, November 3rd, to deliver the keynote. I am so excited to hear him. I called him to go over the details of his talk, which will be called Creative is Not a Noun. I love that title. And afterwards, we kicked back, turned on the audio recorder, and we talked about a broad range of things. The last episode of this podcast, I did a whole kind of meditation on paper and all the things I love about it and all the different forms that it takes. And I happened to read this article in the Washington Post. It's actually a video as well about this restaurant in Freedom, Maine. I don't know if you heard about it. It's called The Lost Kitchen. It's like this very hot restaurant. And they were besieged by people leaving phone messages on their machine trying to make reservations. And so they decided that they're going to change their whole system. And the way the system works now is you have to send them a postcard. And that's how you get a reservation, is by sending them a postcard that you've made. So they had all these people they got 20,000 postcards, and then they would randomly pick one. They would have like whoever was available here, the busboy, pick one, and that would be the thing. And they, in this video, they show all these postcards, and they're just gorgeous. Like, people really went to town making these beautiful things. And I know that you, like, you love paper, you love sketchbooks, you love notebooks, and all that kind of stuff. And I just wanted to talk to you a bit about that, and like what kind of what extent that passion has for you. Like, what are you really sort of nerdy about paper and the feeling of books and so forth?
I'm not a real fussy person when it comes to materials. I'm sort of overall, I'm obsessed with paper, and I'm sort of like the idea of paper I'm obsessed with, and I love it and I use it. I'm not particularly fussy about what the poundage is or what it feels like. You know, I mean, it's more of a utilitarian thing for me. But I believe so deeply in the power of it. And I think what's interesting to me is just how, I think I probably feel the way I do about paper just because we're in this incredibly digital era. I mean, I think if you sort of like kind of poke around history, you'll find that whenever, you know, one form kind of ascends, whatever is being kind of pushed out, there's kind of a leap in interest in that other thing. So like, for example, you know, MP3s, or digital streaming with music, like rises, and then all of a sudden you've got, you know, people listening to records again and vinyl. And I think the same thing has kind of happened with paper, which is like, you know, you have this, you know, it's just becoming this very digital zeros and ones world. And there's paper, which is kind of this, you know, really tactile thing that is actually incredibly durable. I mean, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, do you upload all your sketchbooks to the cloud so you, you know, so you have like them backed up or whatever? And it's really funny to me because I'm like, you know, I have sketchbooks from when I was 13 that I can still open and read. And I have hard drives that are 3 years old that I can't read. You know what I mean? So it's like the kind of like, I think people's ideas about what lasts and what's durable. I don't trust the cloud at all with much, you know? And it's interesting because once my books are printed, I have this kind of relief because I'm like, okay, well, if I lose all this art and writing, at least I have these books that float around on these shelves. You know, it's this funny thing. And I think some people, I have, I do Twyla Tharp's thing in the Creative Habit. She has this thing she recommends where she starts a banker's box for every project.
Right.
So I do that now, and I just, these boxes just fill up with paper. And I think some people would throw it out, but for me, it's just like such a great little time capsule. You know, I don't want to get rid of them.
I know, particularly when you have kids, which I know you have a couple sons.
Yeah, I do.
My son is now, he just turned 25, and I still have, books that, you know, with the plastic sleeves, and I've four or five volumes of them called The Art of Jack T. Gregory. And
yeah.
it's like page after page of these, like every chicken scratching that he did before,
yeah,
when he was, you know, up to the age of about 8 or 9, and scans certainly don't capture that.
I like paper with kids because it's just so, there's just nothing beats it. I mean, my son Jules, who is 3 right now, I would say he probably goes through one of those like copy paper reams probably every week or two.
Wow.
You know, yeah, he just fills it. And, you know, we as a family have kind of, I think some people would be like, oh, that's so wasteful and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we as a family are, we just decided like we'll go through a lot of paper. That's just the expense and that's what we do. And one of my heroes, Linda Berry, who I'll probably talk about again, because when I think of drawing, I think of Linda, and so much of what I've learned about drawing, I've learned from her. And she talks about being a kid and her mom, you know, she had a rough childhood, and she talks about her mom like yelling at her for using up paper, and how it kind of created this I think it turned paper into a fetish object for her in some ways, which probably led to what it is that she does. But she's a paper hoarder now. And so she just like, she talks about just like hoarding every little scrap of paper she comes across. And it's funny because I do think that I've been thinking, I just wrote this new book called Keep Going. And one of the sections is about tidying, and it's sort of pushing back against this thing going on in our culture now where people are really you know, the Marie Kondo magic hoarders, pack rat. There's this kind of thing in the culture right now that pack rats are really, it's a bad time to be a pack rat, basically. And I think that all I wrote in Steal Like an Artist, most artists are collectors of some kind. And I said, not a hoarder, mind you, there's a difference.
Right.
But after I wrote that, I kind of am starting to think, no, actually, I think artists are hoarders because you don't know what you're going to need and you don't know what you're going to use. But that's just a roundabout. I kind of went off topic there, but I just think for me, there's just such a magic to having, to watching, you know, for one thing, there's a magic to watching the notebook stack up. You know, I just, the physicality of it, I like my version of notebook pornography is not actually looking inside of people's notebooks as much as I love to see like someone's trunk of sketchbooks, you know, or like a big stack of one of my cartoonist heroes, James Kochalka, has this picture of just the stack of his notebooks he used to draw his comic strip American Elf. And it's just 14 years of notebooks. And it's like, it's, I don't know how many feet high it is, but he took this picture of it. And the designer, Michael Beirut, I know he was had like a stack of his composition books he's been using for 30 years. I just love that kind of that paper monument to human effort. You know,
I do.
It's the kind of thing that I really kind of get off on.
I'll send you a picture of my cabinets because I have a wall of cabinets, which is all filled with sketchbooks and writing books, all in like neat rows on shelves. And that's always been my favorite thing. In fact, I remember I interviewed James for this book I did about people who keep sketchbooks and just having this whole, I mean, so many of people are obsessive in some cases it's making their own sketchbooks. In some cases it's always having exactly the same kind or having different ones for different use. I know that you kind of have different ones that you're going on at the same time, right?
Yeah. I started using this, like this off brand company. They sent me some and I was like, these are really nice. I'm going to order more of them. And then I like ordered a box of them cause I liked them so much. And then they started falling apart. So now I'm using them, but like people ask me like, well, can you recommend like what notebook do you use? And I'm just sort of like, I can't tell you because like, they fall apart. But I do. It is funny because people make fun of the Moleskine or Moleskin, however you say it. Like, but those everyone I have has still like held up. And I keep three different notebooks. So I'm kind of like, I have these three different notebooks at all times. And so I could, if at the risk of boring everyone to death, I guess I could, but
tell us what they
describe
are.
Them. So the one I carry around all the time is like one of those hardback, it's like a credit card size, basically. It's like a very small, it's like the size of an iPhone, like an old iPhone. Mm-hmm. Not one of those big monstrous ones, but like it's like a very tiny hardback notebook. And that's one that in the morning I date stamp the page. And then I just like any idea I have, I have a pencil that I tie around it like with a rubber band. And like any idea I have throughout the day goes in that book. And that's like my scratch notebook that I keep. So that's like one notebook and that's on me all the time. And then I have what I call my logbook, and my logbook is like half the size of a paperback book. It's like a tiny little Moleskine daily diary. And what that's for is every day I write down what I did the day before. And so it sounds like a diary. It's actually not. It's literally, it's like a reverse date book. So it's like, I write down, got up, took walk, ate breakfast. It's very boring. You know, it's like, I'll write down, talk to Danny for an hour, you know, just like, just, it'll be, went to the grocery, you know, but it's literally just a list of what I did throughout the day. And that sort of becomes like an index of my life. And I use that as a way to almost find other stuff and just to kind of like keep a record of what happens to me. And I've been doing that for like 10 years. So that's like the thing that's been most constant throughout the past decade for me.
So you refer back to that when you say, oh, I had an idea on when I was doing something. What else was I doing at that time?
Yeah, or I'll be like, when was I in Belgium? Well, I think it was, you know, I might look it up in my Google Calendar or something and say, oh, well, that was 2014. Okay, let me look it up in my logbook. Oh, that's right. I went here and here. And then what I might do is I keep, and then I'll go on to my third notebook, which is probably the most substantial. But what I do right now is I have a good old fashioned diary, and this is like the size of a paperback book, but it's like really fat. And I fill one of these about every month and a half. And what I do is no matter what, I sit down in the morning and I'll fill out my logbook and I'll look at my scratch notebook that I carry around, my little pocket one, and I'll write about the day before in the morning over breakfast. And sometimes I'll do a collage. Sometimes my primary thing that I draw in there is I'll draw comics of like funny things my kid says. So, and then he likes to read the comics. So he'll want to see my comics that I've drawn about him in the notebook. But that's like a very old fashioned diary, basically. So I will write about, and that's actually, I've been doing this for about 2 years now. And this is the book where most of my new book came from. Like the ideas that are in the diary, like that really kind of led to this new book. So this system is actually sort of modified from that I've like kind of cobbled together. This is actually, I was inspired by David Sedaris because I knew David Sedaris was the writer David Sedaris was, he was, I knew that all of his pieces came from his diary, but I didn't know how he did them. And he just put out a book of his diaries called Theft by Finding. Mm-hmm. And I was reading another book of his where he actually talks about how he keeps a notebook. And when I discovered that what he does is he just keeps notes all day and then he writes about the day the next morning, that sort of unlocked something for me. And I realized that like, oh, morning is when I'm most on. That's when I'm most meditative. That's when I should try to write. Because I used to try to write a diary at the end of the night. Right. And I was just too tired. And I just like couldn't do it. And it was hard to keep up. So once I switched to the morning, like something really great happened. And now I have this system that just like I never lack for something to write about. The other thing I do on the digital side of things is I keep a daily blog now. And I've noticed that my notebook system really makes sure that I always have something for the daily blog. Like that's where a lot of those daily blog posts come from. And then of course the daily blog sort of becomes the books. And so I really feel like for people who are trying to do creative work, I believe very much in the dailiness of creative work. I think you need like a daily system for producing work. And I don't really think it matters what it is, but there needs to be some sort of process. Like there needs to be some sort of system in which you never really have to worry about whether you're producing. You just kind of do things, you know? So for other people, it might be different. Like it might just be like, oh, you know, you fill three pages of your sketchbook or you, you know, it doesn't really matter what it is, but I find that little daily chunks of effort over time, they build up into something new. And so I'm a very additive guy. It's like, okay, you've got this little notebook, you take notes in, and then they become bigger diary entries. And then you take these diary entries and they turn into blog posts. And then you might put the blog posts together into another big blog post, or you might put them in a talk. And then that talk might become a book, you know? So it's this very like iterative sort of Katamari ball, right. You know what I mean? Of just like gathering things.
Right. Eating the whale.
Yeah. So it's like, but I'm just like, I think more than sketchbook people, see, I used to be very, you know, I'm someone who considers himself a writer who draws. So primarily I see myself as a writer. And the drawing is sort of like a, it's something I almost do on the side, or it's like a, it's like an auxiliary power or something. I don't know. But like for me, I also think that writing and drawing are so interwoven in my mind now because it's all ink on paper. But for me, I primarily see myself as a writer, and so I've just. In the old, you know, 10 years ago, I think I was more inspired by like looking at people's sketchbooks and like visual stuff. But now I'm very much inspired by diarists. So I've been reading a lot of David Sedaris, a lot of Henry David Thoreau is my favorite journalist or journal keeper or diary keeper. I actually love Andy Warhol's diary, which was actually him dictating what he did to his assistant, and then she transcribed it. So it's sort of a different thing. But and also like someone like Virginia Woolf was really good. But that's sort of where I am in my work. And I think diarying, you know, when I first started keeping those logbooks, it was away from putting the effort into a diary. But now my daily diary is just so incredibly valuable to me because it's really where I discover what I'm really thinking about and what I'm really going through.
I want to morph into talking about Steal Like an Artist because I feel like so much of what I get from your process, whether it's on your blog or in your newsletters and then ultimately in your books, is this sort of the way that you're constantly filling your well with stuff and that you're interested in so many different things and all these ideas sort of accumulate. And obviously the part of the creative process that you're really intensely focused on is this gathering. And then ultimately it's about it all kind of coming together in new and interesting ways. Can you talk a bit about that, about this yeah. process of it's, and I've heard it referred to as remixing, and I don't think that's really what it is. I think it's more this giant soup pot of stuff that kind of breaks down and forms new flavors. But tell me a bit about your perspective on that. What goes into it and what comes out of it?
Well, I think that primarily, I see what I do through the lens of collage. I'm a huge fan of like collage as a form, and I think that collage is really where my mind is most active. So collage is something that I do when I really don't know what to do next. I make collages. And there's something about the act of collage that really activates my brain. And I've noticed in my life that I have to be doing a lot of different things at the same time. And then the things talk to each other and they create this new thing. And so that's sort of the magic of it. And I think my books in particular are sort of, they are collages of the books I've read in like the past 5 years, you know, and that's how I really feel about them. They're almost like I was talking to an artist recently, and her name's Lucy Bellwood, and she has a dad who taught screenwriting, and he would kind of collect quotes and he would make these little like zines that he would pass out to his students. And she said, you know, your books really remind me of my dad's little zines they gave to his students. And I was like, well, yeah, that's how I feel about my books. They're like fancy zines, mm-hmm. you know, that someone like photocopied and pasted together. But I, you know, as I have studied, you know, my books are really the result of me trying to figure out how to be an artist. And so as I was studying other artists, it just became clear to me that, you know, you have to devour, you're so much the result of what you eat, garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. Like you are what you eat, like input and output, like so many of the greats, it's about like sort of taking in and then putting out, you know? And I, when I was younger, I felt so much this pull towards having to be original. I felt like, well, what artists do is they just have like, they're special people and they tap into what's special about them and they use their talents to just make this brilliant work. And like, that's how it works. And that's how I thought it worked for a long time. And now I just have the opposite feeling. I think that artists are, you know, they're normally talented people, but more than anything, they're obsessed by certain things and they spend a lot of time and effort kind of devouring with their attention certain things. And I think that, you know, for artists in particular, I think that most artists are the result of like, you know, 9 or 10 different artists that they've tried to copy. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think that you basically, you start out and you just, you know, you love, I'm going to blank here, but you know, you start out and you're just like aping one particular, I'll use music as an example. You know, it's like when I was younger, I just loved Green Day. And so, you know, the minute I heard Green Day, my friends and I, like, we wanted to start a 3-piece punk band. And we're just like, okay. So we started this band and it was all Green Day. So, like, it sounded like a bad version of Green Day. And then as I studied, I found out, oh, well, Green Day, they listen to this band called The Clash. And okay, well, let's listen to The Clash. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. The Clash, they do like all kinds of different, you know. And then it's like, okay, well, they were also listening to this band called The Ramones. And you start listening to The Ramones. Oh, well, The Ramones are in, they do these like pop songs and they are into this guy named Phil Spector. Maybe I should. So, you know, I have this kind of model for artists where it's like you start with the artist that really inspires you. And then you just figure out everything there is to know about that artist and you figure out who influenced that artist. And then you start finding this whole web. You sort of like build your own history of the art form. You can do that literally by just starting with one artist. And I always find it interesting that I use music as an example because I think music was really my first passion. And that's the thing I really understand in terms of these webs of influence. But you can do it for any art form. You know, you start... you start at one point, you start with whatever sort of makes you feel alive to your own gifts, and then you just figure it out from there. But I think like watching my sons, it's been so interesting to me to realize copying is just how we learn. This is how we exist. This is how humans have developed themselves. From the beginning, you don't come from nothing, you know, right. Nothing comes from nowhere. You literally discover who you are by emulating other people and trying on different outfits. And, you know, you have to wear like a dozen different skins before you find your own, you know, that's just like sort of how it happens. And, people talk about voice a lot, discovering your voice, and I never knew what they were talking about. And I finally heard the poet Billy Collins. He said, well, your voice is just the result of a dozen people whose voices you've tried to mimic. Right. You know, that's your own voice. That's how you find it. And I just think that was so powerful. So that's really the, that's really where the Steal Like an Artist thing comes from. It comes from, you know, not, when you're starting out, not running away from influence, but running towards it and trying to grab as much as you can. And I think there's a political element to influence in terms of, you know, I think whatever influence you run towards can be a corrective to what's happening in your life right now. So, you know, I have, with this book, I was really, really inspired by women. I really, you know, I had had a little bit of criticism from my last books where there were so many male voices and not enough female voices. Mm-hmm. And I took that really seriously. And I really took a look at my own life and was like, what am I devouring? And so for this new book, I really tried to just kind of soak myself in this more kind of in a more I've always felt like I was really influenced by women, but it just wasn't coming out in the work. And so like, I really tried to concentrate with this next book on, you know, really saturating myself in these women artists that I love, people like Carita Kent and Hannah Hawk and like, Nina Cacciadorian and Amy Krauss Rosenthal. I'm looking at I have this board above my desk that has all my like kind of artistic heroes. So I'm kind of like naming them off. Virginia Woolf, you know? And so like, I think that who you run towards influentially, it affects the work that you do, you know? And so influence can be like really aspirational. Tove Jansson, the woman who did the Moomin comics, you know, but that's, but like, it, you know, whoever you want to become, you know, again, I just think it's that idea of you aren't born with this stuff. You have to like figure it out. You got to kind of build yourself.
So you're going to be talking at SketchCon, and SketchCon is, you know, this convention that we're holding of people who are interested in drawing and painting. And a lot of it has grown out of Sketchbook School, which is a lot of the way that we teach is very much along the lines of what you're describing, because our theory is there's no one way to learn art, and there's no one way to make art, and that basically you just need to be exposed to as many different artists and their work as possible, and that those are ultimately one tablespoon at a time going to fill the kind of cauldron of your own creativity. And so most of our classes are designed to have a new teacher every week. And that's sort of the idea behind what we're going to be doing at SketchCon as well, is it's going to be like this sort of three-ring circus of presentations and assignments and kind of creative demonstrations and opportunities to make stuff and so forth. And most of the people who are going to be there are illustrators and artists and visual artists, but we've asked you to be our keynote speaker in sort of dead bang in the middle of the whole event, because I feel like so much of the message of what you have written about is so pertinent to tying this together and to sort of saying to people, it's not about learning a technique. You know, people say, oh, I'd love to learn how to draw. Right. And we always say, what we want to teach you is how to learn how to love to draw, so that you'll always keep doing it and you'll keep experimenting with it. And yeah, your techniques and your skills will improve, but that's not really the objective. The objective is to incorporate this into a lifetime of making stuff, and that's ultimately the most rewarding kind of life you can have. And clearly you live that kind of a life. You make things all the time. But I wanted to ask you about amateurism, because that's really a lot of the focus of what we do, is to say it's not about teaching you professional skills like an art school would. Right. It's about encouraging you to have a creative habit where you make things all the time, and that you see like an artist, that you see the world as an artist. And I love what you say when you talk about the importance of just making things and then waiting to see, maybe something will come with them, maybe it won't. They'll take on a life of their own. But that ultimately it's not about drawing so much that eventually you can become an illustrator. It's not about turning your passion for creativity into a profession, because there's frankly a lot of downsides to that too, to sort of marrying your mistress. Talk a bit about that, about this idea of living a creative life, and that whether it turns into your, you know, the way you put bread on the table or not is less important than all the richness that it will bring you.
Well, the thing I try to remind people with, you know, I'm a language guy, I'm a writer. And so I always try to remind people of the origin of the term amateur. Now, amateur is used in this sort of pejorative sense, in that, you know, oh, he's an amateur. Or, ah, that's amateur, you know. But in the old days, amateur in the French literally means lover of. And in the old days, amateur was not pejorative in the sense it is now. An amateur was someone who literally just did something for love. And so to be an amateur painter did not mean that you were necessarily a lesser painter. It just meant you didn't make money off your paintings. And so the amateur spirit is something I talk a lot about in my book, Show Your Work, because I find that the amateur spirit carries one forward a lot further and to much more interesting places than the professional spirit. There, Milton Glaser talks really beautifully about this. He says, you know, he talks a lot about how professional growth and personal growth are at odds. And the reason, he says, is that professional growth is all about you find something that you can do better than anybody else, and you do it, and you keep doing it until you retire, basically. That, you know, when you're a professional, you sort of glom onto the style and you just, and this one kind of technique or whatever, and you just like run that into the ground as a brand, you know, you just make as much money off as you can off of that one thing. That's how people know you. And you just
and
go
branding, this whole obsession and we have with branding.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to be consistent. I had that conversation with illustrators who were just like, well, I can't really experiment because I'm known for doing like fine line drawings with a block of color behind them. And if I stop doing that, what will I become? You know?
Yeah. And so we all, but what we know is this happens in school too. When kids start out, I mean, my sons don't have any real, I mean, they do have style. They have their work has personality, but they don't have any idea that they're supposed to just be one thing. So my son can sit down and make comics and it's no big deal. And like, he can go and record music and it's no big deal. And he can read books about the human body and like go explore out in the yard. Nobody's telling him like, oh, well, you know, you need to stick to your piano playing or you need to stick to your botany. You know, I mean, he's this like kind of omnivorous like person. And, you know, you talked about James Cattralka before. I think James is a person that has discovered he's a multi-talented person, mm-hmm. but he's also discovered that all this stuff sort of has a thread through it, which is really the art of discovery, is that, you know, you're interfacing with the world. You're pointing your attention in this certain direction or in multiple directions. And so I just think the amateur spirit, while it might not help you always commercially, it'll keep you alive. You know, I think that is a kind of old fashioned, I can't believe that this has become old fashioned, but the thing I like about old fashioned things is that the more old fashioned they get, the more kind of subversive and interesting they become. And so I feel like we're at this moment right now where if you stand up in a group of people and you say, you know, the best thing about drawing is that it makes you feel alive. That's the best thing about drawing. Like, it's not, you know, if someone pays you $1,000, for a drawing, it's not going to feel as good as when you're really on and you made the perfect line or you really were able to capture something, you know? And I think that I also think that what happens with people is, and it certainly happened to me in my career, I chased after things that I thought I was supposed to do that didn't make me feel alive in terms of a career. And then I suddenly discovered, what I eventually discovered is that if you really follow the things that make you feel alive and you pay attention to them and you spend a lot of time on them, what happens is that, you know, eventually you get good enough at them that maybe they will get you somewhere that's more commercial. But I mean, you know, that could happen. It could not happen. But I just think that we do not emphasize in this culture enough that the arts are supposed to make your life better. They are for the enjoyment of life. They help us enjoy life. They help us, drawing in particular, there's a whole chapter about this in my new book, which is drawing is a form of paying attention. When you are drawing something, you're paying attention to it and you're really looking at it for what it is. And the magic of drawing is not getting a finished drawing, it's seeing. It's you're able to see the world better when you draw.
Right.
And it makes the world more beautiful, actually, when you draw it. And I think my new sort of mission or goal really is to help people rediscover this very simple fact. And, you know, I think the side hustle stuff and the, you know, the wanting to monetize your hobbies, I think all of that comes out of the economic anxiety of the age. I mean, people have never been more strapped. They've never, the despair between people who have a lot, the disparity between people who have a lot and people who have nothing has never been greater. I mean, we're entering this new gilded age, basically. And so I think that a lot of what we see, that kind of side hustle, that kind of like, well, turn your blog into a living or, you know, make money off your art stuff. I think a lot of that comes from just the economic and social climate that we're in. But I think if you think long term about this stuff, you just have to be really careful, because I think the easiest way to destroy a passion in a lot of ways is to turn it into your breadwinning.
I mean, I think another,
that's a real thing.
I think that that's absolutely very insightful. I think another thing that's going on now is you can get an audience. Like when I was a teenager, if I wanted to, you know, write stories or make art, what was I going to do with it? You know, maybe
right.
I could send it into a magazine and who knows, maybe one day, you know, one of the things would get selected. But now you can make something and you can put it out there. And so I think it just encourages many more people to make much more stuff. And I think we have to remember that that is its own reward rather than necessarily having to turn it into an Etsy store or publish it as a self-published book. I mean, that's all very yeah. nice, but it's not your obligation. Your obligation is to yourself and to just keep creating. Yeah.
Yeah. I think like, I just think that this world is, and this is an ancient idea. I mean, you know, I was just reading Thoreau's journal this morning and September 7th, 1851, he was writing about how he felt like most people just weren't alive to the world. I mean, that was really his great insight. And that's really the insight of a lot of the great philosophers and writers, is that most people sleepwalk through life. And what the arts do is it helps you wake up to your world. And I really think that is the true joy and value of drawing, is that it wakes you up to the world. It makes you feel alive. It fires at least two of your senses, you know?
Right.
And senses are exactly what we're sort of lacking in this world right now. People with sense, not just common sense, or sense, but the senses. People are divorced from their senses, you know, and drawing brings you back into at least two of them.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, drawing changed my life when I started drawing in my late 30s, and it completely redirected me in a new direction. And I think a lot of the people who are going to be at SketchCon are going to have that kind of understanding, awareness, and ambition too, to just go deeper into it, to learn more and more. I think when we start to draw, we think, I don't know how to draw a straight line, or I want to learn how to draw a bowl of fruit or a likeness of somebody. And I think ultimately you start to realize when you live your life as you also do, observing everything around you, recording it, creating new memories, creating new insights, seeing things more clearly, recognizing beauty in all its many forms, life just gets better. It gets easier. You know, it's a fantastic way to live. So we're going to have 500 people who are all, I think, going to be really interested in hearing what you have to say. And I hope that you're also going to be part of this experience. You're going to be part of this convention, and hopefully you'll get a chance to do some drawing and to make some stuff while you're there with us in Pasadena.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. I think it's going to be really fun. Well, thanks so much for coming, with us to talk, and also for joining me on this podcast today. And your talk is going to be on Saturday night, right before we have our big evening gala party, where we're going to have a drink and draw and celebrate Day of the Dead, and I don't know, get drunk and draw naked people or something like that. So it should be a lot of fun. So prepare yourself for that. Thanks again for chatting today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, cool. Isn't Austin great? I hope you can see why I was so adamant about having him speak at SketchCon. And I hope that you're going to be there in Pasadena on November 2nd through 4th to hear him speak in person. He's looking forward to being a part of the convention, to drawing with us, signing books, and hanging out and chatting and sharing ideas. And you can buy him a drink at the Day of the Dead Drink and Draw right after his talk. Just sign up at sketchcon.com. And I also hope that you and your watercolor sketchbook are going to be joining me and Kosha and Ian Sidaway and Ian Fennelly and August Wren and Inma Serrano in our new course, Watercolor Rules and How to Break Them. It starts next week, but you can find out more about it at sketchbook.school. But hurry up. I hope you got some beautiful creative work done while you listened to our conversation, and I hope that you found our ideas useful, inspiring, amusing, a way to pass the time. If you did, or if you didn't, please subscribe and give us some feedback. We try to make lots of different sorts of episodes for you on this podcast and to cover lots of different topics that we think that you'll find useful. And we'd love to hear from you so we can make art for all even better. You can email me at danny@sketchbookschool.com, or you can come up and chat with me in Pasadena. In the meantime, subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Leave some encouraging words in the review. Tell all of your friends about this incredible resource that you found here. And check in with me next week. Until next time, I'm Danny Gregory, your humble creative sidekick. And this is Art for All.